91.3 WLRN presents Topical Currents. This hour we visit with certified chef and nutritionist Stephanie Sachs, who's written a book which states that many health issues stem from the local grocery aisle. Good afternoon, Joseph Cooper and Bonnie Berman. She says food labeled low-fat, sugar-free, or even natural and hormone-free have us assume we're making healthy choices about the food we eat. She has a list of the top 10 things in our foods which can cause harm, as well as insight to decode misleading terminology. Of course, we're joined the full hour with Topical Currents food and dining expert Linda Gassenheimer. And, of course, we'll take your calls. Food and Dining up next with wine columnist Fred Tasker as well, after NPR and Regional News. And we return. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper along with Bonnie Berman. It is Food and Dining Thursday, and we're joined by chef, author, syndicated columnist, and of course, Topical Currents food and dining producer, our friend Linda Gassenheimer. Hello, Linda.
Great to be with you. Fun program today. Interesting.
As always. Well, our full hour is devoted to health and nutrition, and Linda will join us
in just a moment, and we'll visit with another chef and certified nutritionist, Stephanie Sachs. She's also a public radio host in Eastern Long Island. We'll discuss her book, What the Fork Are We Eating? That's What the Fork Are We Eating? An Action Plan for Your Pantry and Plate.
Okay, and let's also welcome Fred Tasker, our favorite wine guy. Fred's joining us by Skype. And you can read his wine column that is now in Saturday Food Section of the Miami Herald. Hello, Fred. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Well, you folks are going to talk about what's in our food, so I guess I'll talk about what's in our wine.
Oh, good.
Okay, all great. Right. Good for you.
All right. Welcome, Stephanie.
Thank you.
Good to have you with us. Now, I understand you suffered from a plethora of health issues as a child. If you'll tell us about that and what was wrong and what led you to food as the solution?
Well, I think it probably started when I was three, and I loved to cook. And it was a wonderful outlet. I had a wooden play kitchen in a playroom, and I would always play restaurant and make my grandmother food when she would come over. And I suffered probably from the age of like eight forward with terrible environmental allergies and asthma and recurring bronchitis, pneumonia, and I kept going from doctor to doctor and was put on more medication, and nobody was talking to me about any other solutions. So here I was, a young kid going into my tweens and then teens and adolescence on a lot of different medication, and then at the age of 15, I started cooking in a health food store in my hometown. Well, at that point, it was where I used to spend summers. And when I wasn't in the kitchen, I was reading voraciously, and I was looking at products, and I picked up a book called Food and Healing by Anne Marie Coleman. And she is the founder of the Natural Gourmet Institute for Health and Culinary Arts in New York City. And this book spoke to me. She really talked about how food choice can impact health and how everything that we put in our mouths has some sort of health impact on our bodies. And so while my friends were drinking Coke and sipping it out of Twizzler straws, as I like to say, and often remember, I have this image in my mind, I was questioning where my chicken came from. I was wanting to know what everything meant on an ingredient label. And I started to shift my diet as I learned, and I started to feel better, but not well enough. And then in the late 80s, I had the great honor of working with a doctor named Sherry Rogers in Syracuse, New York, and she wrote a book called Tired of Toxic. And this was before the age of the internet, where all of this information, which is now so accessible, it wasn't very accessible, and I can't even recall how I found her. But she put me on a very strict diet called the Candida diet, which removed yeast It removed sugar. It removed all fermented foods, dairy from my diet. And within 1 month, I actually went from 5 medications to 1 medication.
Well, that's amazing, Stephanie.
It is.
That's
it is
fantastic
amazing.
That you found food really helped you. It's Linda talking, Stephanie. Stephanie, your book talks about what lurks in our food, and we can understand now why you went into such detail about food and what's in it and what are we eating. And I was impressed by what you said in the book, that our government regulates, can tell you what kind of claims you're going to have on your package, but they don't go in and they don't really actually find out what's actually in the food and what's happening. And so, you know, let's talk a little bit, Stephanie, about what you found about what we're actually eating.
Well, I think one of the most important things for people to understand is most of the terms that we see on our food, whether it's natural or antibiotic-free or cage-free or hormone-free, these are terms that are defined by our government, but sadly not regulated. We have a very loose food regulation system.
Let's talk about that for a minute, about this loose system, because let's go to something specific like organic. Now, organic kind of worries me, and let me tell you why. Mm-hmm. Because I have a concern. You know, big box stores like Walmart and Costco, supermarkets, they're all putting in organic sections, and I'm thinking to myself, do we really grow that much organic food in the United States?
But isn't organic strictly regulated, Stephanie?
Yeah, so through the National Organic Program, the United States Department of Agriculture's National Organics Program, we have a universal, uniform regulation system. It's a standardization for organics. But within that system, there are certain things that are allowable that would never be allowed in what we look at as sort of more traditional historical organics. So, for example, there is an allowable list of pesticides that are used in organics.
Can I stop you just for half a minute, because I'm not sure I understand. When you say there's an allowable list of pesticides,
pesticides were taboo.
That's from the government's standards, or?
That's from the government standards.
So it's kind of been watered down, the organic definition, do you think?
It has been watered down a bit, absolutely. I think that there are some wonderful organizations like Food and Water Watch and other non-governmental organizations that are keeping a very, very close eye on the National Organics Program and really trying to keep it in check and better it. But I do believe, based on my research, that there are some things that are permissible that would never have been considered organic or part of the organic philosophy before it was part of the standardized system. However, that being said, I do think that it's a great option for so many people. And we do define it, and actually our government does regulate it through third-party verifiers. So when something says organic, you can essentially trust that it is being regulated.
When you said third party, what do you mean by that?
So third-party verification means that There are certifiers that go out that don't have any special interest connected to the government, connected to the farm, connected to industry, that go and inspect farms.
Who supports them? How are they paid?
That's a great question. I don't know. I know certain organizations that are doing it, and they're not for profit. And they're funded through philanthropic organizations who are trying to better our food system. But I don't know who the third-party verifiers are.
That always kind of worries me. Where's the money coming from? Yeah.
So these third-party verifiers, do they also verify cage-free, farm-raised, free-range, free-roaming? Are those labels overseen?
No, those labels are actually not overseen unless you're looking for a third-party verification through an organization called Animal Welfare Approved or Certified Humane. And another thing that I do want to point out as we're talking about organics is in 2002 when the standards were put in place, there were a lot of small farms who were practicing organic farming that couldn't afford the verification. So an alternative system was developed called Certified Naturally Grown, which has a participatory guarantee system, which really is an alliance of these farmers who all keep each other in check. And I actually really love that label. It's called CNG.
It's called Certified, say it again,
Naturally,
please.
Certified Naturally Grown. And you'll find that at a lot of farmers markets, for example.
And what does that exactly mean?
What that means is that your product was raised or grown according to organic standards, meaning real historical organic standards. So a high level of sustainability, no pesticide use, no antibiotic use, no hormone use in animals. And so it is actually a label that you can trust.
It's an alternative. Let's make sure again, that's regulated by whom?
Certified Naturally Grown is an independent organization.
Okay.
Yeah. It's an independent. Right. They're not connected to our government. They're a coalition of farmers, small farmers that couldn't afford to get the organic certification because it's quite expensive.
Oh, I see.
So the food is quite expensive.
No. To get the organic label to go into the organic system, for some farms, that's too expensive.
Oh.
Yeah.
Right.
So they can't get the organic label just because it's too expensive to actually be certified organic?
Yep, some of them can't. Hmm. So the Certified Naturally Grown is an alternative. And some of them won't go through the hassle. And some of them believe that their standards are too loose.
Stephanie Sachs is a certified chef, a certified nutrition specialist, and a certified dietitian nutritionist. She hosts Stirring the Pot Radio on NPR member station WPPB. And her book is What the Fork Are You Eating? An Action Plan for Your Pantry and Plate. On today's Topical Currents, we're going to take a short break. When we come back, we're going to ask you, our listeners, to join in the conversation.
And we're back. It is today's Topical Currents. Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman, Linda Gassenheimer, Fred Tasker. And our special guest today is Stephanie Sachs. She's a nutritionist and a chef. She's the author of What the Fork Are We Eating? An Action Plan for Your Pantry and Plate. Very interesting discussion so far. If you'd like to join us, that's easy enough. 1-800-743-9576, 1-800-743-9576, or perhaps you prefer to email radio@wlrn.org, radio@wlrn.org.
So getting back to this certified naturally grown, one of your biggest pet peeves, Stephanie, you say, is the use of the term natural. So what constitutes by FDA and USDA standards right now, what does natural mean?
So naturally, and I'm not going to link this at all to the term certified naturally grown, because one has nothing to do with the other. But the term natural is defined by the FDA, and it's simply defined as minimally processed without anything artificial. But like all of these types of labels that we're seeing on our food that actually prompt us to pick up food and buy it, because it's not often that people will turn it over and actually read the ingredient list, which are what tell the story of your food or the true story of your food. What happens is we buy into all of these labels, and most of them are defined by the FDA but not regulated. So it's up to a company's discretion to put whatever label they want on their food based on a set of regulations that's in the, it's called the Code of Federal Regulations that our government puts out. So a company will look at that and say, okay, I have to adhere to these rules and adhere to these types of claims, and this is how I can say it, this is how I can't say it. But the government doesn't regulate it. So there are a lot of companies that will go out and they will put certain things on their food. And you take a perfect example is Rice Krispies. And several years ago, I think it was in 2011, they had a huge banner on their product that said, boost children's immunity. And there were a band of consumers who came together and went to the Federal Trade Commission, which is another branch of our government, and complained about this and said, this isn't truthful, this is misleading. And in turn, the company was sued for, I think it was about $5 million for falsifying claims. And so, but that's a long, laborious process.
Right,
and
but so, Stephanie, just for in general, I mean, we see natural. I see natural all the time. And I'm thinking to myself, what does it mean? It doesn't mean anything. You know, arsenic, it's natural. So when we see, and you mentioned Banner. There's so many banners across all the foods now, marketing tools. And so it's hard to know what it means. And you mentioned something I thought was very interesting in your book. Instead of looking at the nutritional labels and things like that, that we should look at the ingredients to explain more about what you meant.
So the ingredient list really tells the story of your food because it tells you what's in your food. You know, the prime example is that when your product boasts that it's trans fat free, meaning it does not contain hydrogenated oils or partially hydrogenated oils that have been proven to be worse for you than saturated fat in elevating cholesterol, in heart disease promotion. When your product says trans fat free, it actually is still allowed to have 0.5 grams or less of trans fats in the product. Okay? So you want to read your ingredient list to see what is actually being used in your food.
So if we were going to look for trans fat in the food and we looked at the ingredients list, what would it say?
It would say partially hydrogenated oils or hydrogenated oils. And you may see partially hydrogenated soybean oil or partially hydrogenated canola oil. It may look like that, or cottonseed oil.
And so we should stay away from those because that would be trans fats.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And so there was a study that came out in 1993 through Walter Willett, who is the head of nutrition and epidemiology at Harvard, in The Lancet that actually came out with a very bold statement that trans fats are highly problematic and causing more heart disease than we ever thought. And he petitioned the government, and the government didn't want to take any kind of action. And then fast forward 13 years later to 2006, that they finally felt there was enough evidence to start labeling our foods.
Right. And well, we have several. Sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you. Do you want to finish?
Let's just give the number out again. Do you read food labels? Do you trust them? Do you have health issues that you feel are related to food? You can call us 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-9576.
Yeah, we have many people here already who want to ask questions. So we have Debbie in West Palm Beach. So, Debbie, what is your question?
Hi. I'm a vegan because of my love for animals and all the cruelty that goes into the food industry, and I know you mentioned something about free-roaming chickens for eggs, and I was told that even if chickens are like let out of their cage for a second or a minute or whatever, they can consider that free-roaming.
Or free-range.
Goodness, you're 100% right. In fact, chickens who are kept in a warehouse, they can actually say that they're free-roaming. Uh-huh. With limited or no access to the outdoors. And so for people who do consume animal foods, and, you know, I'm with you, I would be a full-on vegetarian or even a vegan if my body did not crave animal foods, but my body does, because I'm with you on the animal welfare. We are what we eat, but we're also what they ate and how they were treated. And so there's this wonderful organization. It's the highest humane welfare for all animals, called Animal Welfare Approved, and they're a growing organization. And what they're doing is they're ensuring that farmers are really doing the right thing from birth to slaughter.
Stephanie, in your book, there's a recipe, I think, for scrambled eggs with salmon breakfast.
No, that was actually in my blog post this week.
Okay, in your blog. And it mentioned, it was labeled that the eggs were pasture picked or packed, something about
actually,
in a pasture. Is that a new designation, that they're pasture eggs?
So pastured eggs mean that your chicken were ideally raised on pasture. So they were free to roam, eating a diet that they were intended to eat. And these pastured eggs are actually, it actually was not my recipe. It's a recipe. I wrote a blog called Brain Food, and I featured Rebecca Katz and her new book, The Healthy Mind Cookbook, in that. So it's her recipe. But again, pasture, just like cage-free and free-roaming, and it can be so confusing for people.
So these hens would be able to roam all over the pasture and just lay their eggs where they want, I guess.
Or, yeah, they would have...
Sounds like an Easter egg hunt or something.
I know. Well, you know, I think that they have they have areas set up for laying, like laying areas. But the thing is, again, pastured is defined by the government, but again, not regulated. And that's why if you're going to eat animal foods, and you really care about the humane treatment of animals and, you know, your own health and wellness as well as the health of the environment, I always say to people, look for something that's verified by a third party, ideally animal welfare approved, if not certified humane. And then if you can't go there, certified naturally grown USDA organic can suffice. Minimize your animal food consumption because it's going to cost more to get healthier food, and replace it with more plant-based food. So you're still eating animal foods, but you're doing smaller quantities.
Right. So, Stephanie, what I think I'm hearing from you is that a lot of the government labels have been diluted somewhat. Mm-hmm. So what do we as consumers do?
You know, that's a great question, and that's a large part of the reason why I wrote this book, because I spend my days for the past 15 years helping people one-on-one or in groups navigate the food system and make better choices. And the most important thing to remember in doing this, I'm not an idealist, I'm a realist. I work with people across all socioeconomic backgrounds, okay? And the reality is that you have to meet people where they're at. You have to make them feel good about what they can do and not bad about what they can't do. That is so critically important. But what you can do is be an educated consumer. So what that is not buying into all these labels, understanding that most of these labels you see are there for marketing purposes alone, and that you have to start to look out for some of these verifications that I note in the book. And if you can't find any of them, the wonderful thing is we have the internet at our fingertips, and there are so many ways that you can get food. And so you can find another source if you don't have something locally, or you can make the decision that, you know what, I'm going to go with this for now, and then when I can do something better, I will.
Right. Well, we have so many people who want to talk with you, Stephanie.
Oh, goodness.
Well, this is Alfredo. He's from Homestead. So, Alfredo, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. How are you guys?
Hi.
I was just listening into the conversation. Me and my wife have made a conscious decision years ago, and finally are starting to realize it, of running a small 5-acre sustainable farm. And I use the word sustainable and not organic, because organic, to me, the USDA has done a really bad job of making that clear. My mom has always had problems with pork and with dairy products. She swells up with pork, no matter what it is, oil or otherwise. And
Alfredo, we have kind of a bad connection. Could you speak up a little bit?
Sure, I'll try to speak up a little louder. So my mom has a lot of problems with pork products and with dairy. And what we found was when she drank the goat's milk that I have, which, you know, is unpasteurized, it's straight from the goat. And when she's had pork that we've grown on our farm, she has not had any of the problems that she's had with the, you know, the commercially available product. So I think there's a major problem also with the large industries and some of the stuff that's getting in the processing manner that they're doing.
Okay. Well, thanks for your comments, Alfredo. That's interesting.
Yeah. Stephanie, any comment?
Yeah. I mean, he's 100% right. And that, the interesting thing about goat is that a lot of times humans have a much easier time digesting goat's milk or sheep's milk-based products than they do cow's milk, because a woman's breast milk is more similar in composition to that of a goat or a sheep.
Well, that's interesting.
It's very interesting, yeah. And, you know, this is something that my colleagues, my more clinically minded colleagues have taught me, because if I'm working with a patient who has to go dairy-free and this particular patient is really struggling, they're like, okay, let's put them on goat or sheep and see how they do. Mm. And a lot of times they can tolerate it.
Interesting.
We're speaking with Stephanie Sachs. She's a certified chef, nutrition specialist, and dietitian nutritionist. And she's written What the Fork Are You Eating? On today's Topical Currents, a short break. We'll be right back.
And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer. And we're talking with Stephanie Sachs. She's the author of What the Fork Are You Eating? And as Bonnie said, it's What the Fork Are You Eating? She's been helping us understand what is really in our foods, how to read the labels, and how to make the best choices. And we have so many people who do want to get in and ask some questions. Let's go to, I'm not sure how to pronounce your name. Is it Esriam? Esriam in Boca Raton?
Hello.
Hi. How do you pronounce your name?
Ryan?
That's Ryan. Okay. What's your question?
So before you were talking about organic certification and its validity, and I was wondering how much do pesticides actually affect fruits and vegetables? Because the other day I was at Home Depot, and I noticed that they were selling organic vegetable seeds for planting, and I didn't really understand how even seeds could be greatly affected by pesticides. So I was just wondering how much pesticides could affect the planting. Yeah.
What does an organic seed mean? Stephanie?
Well, when it comes to the seeds, you know, what we're looking at here is so many of the seeds these days are genetically modified. Complements of a company called Monsanto and other biotech giants. And so why they're telling you they're organic seeds is to confirm that they're not genetically modified, because that's not allowed in organics. And also, when a seed is organic, it's grown to those same set of organic standards. Now, whether or not pesticides were applied to, you know, the original plant according to those organic standards based on their short list of allowable pesticides, that's, you know, that's a question. But again, It primarily, because if you're to do any searching on GMO seeds, it's a very hot topic. And so it's ensuring that these plants were not genetically modified.
So what I'm understanding is that when you buy a seed, if it didn't come from an organic plant, then it's not an organic seed.
Right.
Okay, great. Because let's go to the next question, because it goes right into what you've been talking about.
Five?
With GMOs. That's Carol in Miami about genetically modified or foods. Go ahead, Carol.
Oh, hello. How are you all?
Hi.
Yeah, I was bringing up the thing about organic GMO, genetically modified Monsanto, because I buy all my food in Whole Foods. Unfortunately, I buy organic. If that's fortunate or unfortunate, I don't know. But that was one of the things that I was GMO, genetically modified. And there's a new label now that says non-GMO.
Right.
And I was told in Whole Foods that not all of their things say it, because it's hard to get. Like Arrowhead Mills didn't have, and I called them a 1-800 number, and I said, how come you don't have that label on it? Oh, because it's very expensive to get, or it takes a long, long time to get it. So,
right.
but ours is, and da-da-da-da. So I just wanted to contribute that about the GMO, that's important today.
Right.
Yes, it is. It is. And the Non-GMO Project is an organization that is out there verifying products, confirming that, you know, organics, you can presume that
you don't have genetic modification. But there are plenty of other products out there that are not using GMO ingredients that want people to know, because more people are interested in understanding their food and having some level of transparency. So the Non-GMO Project launched several years ago and has a verification system. Now it's a lengthy process and it takes time. Whole Foods as a company has committed to, by 2018, not selling any products containing GMO ingredients. So that's a really positive step. But again, what we have to do as consumers is start to ask some of these really important questions when we're purchasing food.
Al wants to know about palm oil. Is that good or bad? He said he's seeing more of it.
Yeah. So palm oil is quite interesting. It's what's happening is, as companies are removing the trans fats from their food products, and this has been going on for years, they're replacing with palm oil, palm kernel oil, or sometimes even coconut oil. Both are plant-based, and both are saturated fats, okay? So, yes, they're healthy, though. But again, it's about just moderating consumption. One of the issues with palm oil production is the deforestation issue. And so you just want to make sure that when you're consuming, if you can, products with palm oil, that like the Rainforest Alliance, for example, is an organization that verifies palm plantations who are truly sustainably growing and producing.
So I've done some research on this because I really wanted to find out. So many health food stores are talking about coconut oil.
Right.
And mm-hmm. Is it good, is it bad? And what I found out is that the jury's still out. Nobody really knows. And you mentioned that they are saturated fats. Explain a little bit more about that.
Well, you know, every fat that we consume has some level of saturated fat and unsaturated fat. But without getting into too much science, what I like to do is I like to pull the lens back. And I don't like to get people into analysis paralysis, because any food, if overconsumed, even kale, is not good.
I really like your analysis paralysis thing, because I think what's happening is this is something Julia Child always used to talk about, fear of food. And we talk more and more about this. People are afraid to eat this, that, and the other thing.
Yes.
And it's difficult. We need to go into a store and bring food home and make it into a dinner or whatever.
Exactly.
Let's get back to another point you bring up in the book, and that there was a law that came out March 2014, and how they're going to change the food labels. So, and it has something to do with serving sizes. So, can you explain that?
Yeah, so there's a proposition to change the food labels. Right now, the way the nutrition facts are laid out, most consumers are duped because in a very small print at the top, in large print, it will tell you the calories, right?
Yeah.
And then it tells you the serving size, okay? So you look at the calories, and let's say it's 80 calories per serving, right? And then you look at the serving, you're like, 80 calories, that's not a lot. And then you look at the serving size, and it's like a half of a cookie. You know what I mean?
The big deal was ice cream, and the serving size was a quarter of a cup.
A quarter of a cup.
Whoever ate a quarter of a cup of ice cream.
Right, exactly. And, Dr. Lisa Young, who's out of NYU, in New York, she is really one of the leading experts in this area and on portion size. And she wrote a book several years ago called The Portion Teller. And I actually quote her in my book as she weighs in on this. And as I was writing this book, this new sort of proposition came out. So when I started writing the book, I mean, this wasn't even a conversation. But then I added it towards the end because it became part of this nutrition dialogue and all of this news came out about it. Now, whether or not it's actually going to happen in this 2-year proposed time period is another question. We don't know yet. But hopefully what the new label is going to do is it's going to increase you know, the font size of the serving, and it's going to be more clear. So the calories are going to be connected to more realistic serving sizes.
So when it's a can of soda and it says for the serving size, it's really two servings in that can, not the whole can.
Or it's going to say one serving, and it's going to tell you the entire caloric content for that one serving.
Right. Well, now let's go on and help people. We've been talking about what we should do, what if, and everything. Let's help us get this meal on the table. And you have a section in the book about food shopping, and you take us through the supermarket and what we should look for. So can you help us there?
Yeah, so, you know, I spend so much time in the solutions, not the problems. And I lived the problems for many years, and I studied the problems for many years, but I ultimately realized that what I wanted to do was help people shift. And where I can help people shift is when I'm around food.
Right. So we only have about a minute before break. So give us some idea of how do we go through the supermarket? What should we look for?
Well, the first thing is please don't go to the supermarket hungry, number one, okay?
That's always true, yes.
Okay. Number two, give yourself enough time, okay? Give yourself an hour to go to the market, if not more, because sometimes it's really enjoyable perusing. You can enjoy it. Shop the perimeter of the market because that's where most of the fresh food is. Do not shy away from buying frozen produce because sometimes it can be better than what you have available locally. That's another tip. Always look at the ingredient lists. So if you're going into the center and you're reading about all of the products, please flip the cans over, the boxes over. The longer the ingredient list, the more processed your food is. Aim for something that's like 5 to 7 ingredients at best. And if you can't pronounce it, don't buy it.
That's great advice. So bring your glasses to the supermarket and a little extra time. Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. My guest today is Stephanie Sacks. She's the author of What the Fork? Are We Eating? We'll take a short break here, and we'll be back with more. And we're back. I'm Linda Gassenheimer, and we're talking with Stephanie Sacks. She's the author of What the Fork Are You Eating? And she's been helping us understand what is really in our foods, how to read the labels, and how to make the best choices. Just a community note here, this coming Tuesday, February 27th, the Slow Food Miami is going to have their annual Arc of Taste Benefit Dinner. And that's going to take place at, I think I'm pronouncing this right, Pariso Bay in Edgewater. It's also the site of celebrity chef Michael Schwartz's future beach club restaurant on Biscayne Bay. And for tickets, you can go to michaelsgenuine.com. The proceeds are going to benefit the Slow Foods Edible Garden Program. So that's quite a good charity. Get some of those fresh edible foods into the garden foods into the school children. Okay, so today's dinner in minutes. It's time for dinner in minutes. It's balsamic pork scallopini with zucchini sweet potatoes.
Mm, pork.
And it's.
Why do you say pork and look at me?
Yeah, pork.
Who else would be?
Because he loves pork. Okay, this is for you, Joe
oink,
Cooper.
Oink.
All right. You can make the scallopinis by cutting slices off of pork tenderloin, which is really a less fatty piece of meat, and you flatten them. And then they'll only take a couple of minutes to cook. And the sauce is made from balsamic vinegar. It adds a tangy and sweet flavor. And I add some pine nuts that give it a little bit crunchy texture. So all you do is saute the pork on each side for a couple of minutes. Remove it from the pan, add the balsamic vinegar and the pine nuts to the pan for a couple of minutes and put it over the pork. I mean, that's really easy, Joe. You could do that.
You don't flour the little scallopinis?
No,
there.
I'm okay. Just doing it quick and easy. And then for the zucchini and the potatoes, you cut the peel the potatoes, sweet potatoes, cut them into small pieces about an inch, and put them into cold water. Bring it up to the boil for about 5 minutes, and then I slice the zucchini and put that into the water. And in 10 minutes, your meal is ready. There, a little olive oil, salt, and pepper. You're good to go. That complete recipe and a photo. It's at dinnerinminutes.com. And please follow me on Twitter. That's at L. Gassenheimer or Linda Gassenheimer on Instagram. Fred Tasker, what are we drinking? You've been very quiet, Fred. Have you still with us?
I'm still with you. And
okay.
Now, as I said, now that we know what's in our food, we can worry about what's in our wine. And as you will see, you might really want to know. for starters, you probably figure that wine is vegetarian or even vegan, right? It's just fruit, grapes.
Okay.
But actually, it's a little more complicated than that. When wine is aging in oak barrels, it has to be fined, which is to say clarified. And winemakers do this by dropping into the barrel any of a number of substances that are designed to collect any tiny particles of grape skin or leaves or stems and such that are floating there and precipitate them to the bottom. And then they draw the clarified wine off the top. Now, this is where the problem comes in. Some of the substances used for this purpose include egg whites, powdered skim milk, and even diatomaceous earth, which is finely ground skeletal remains of diatoms, which are tiny sea creatures, animals that inhabited ancient seas.
This is all in our wine? Are you putting us off
wine or
what?
Well, it's different ones in different wine. But,
it's used in old-style swimming pool filters.
Yeah, I'm setting up the problem, but I'll give you the solution in a minute, so
okay,
don't
cool.
worry.
Go ahead.
Now, these are all animal products, or even animals, the sea creatures, which renders the wine vegan and maybe not even vegetarian. Now, these substances exist in super tiny amounts, so it probably bothers people who are vegan for moral or ethical or religious reasons more than those who are vegan for health reasons. Still, you might want to avoid them, and you can. You can Google a winery's website and email its consumer relations department asking about them, asking what they use to find their wines. Or if you wanted to do it simply, you can just buy kosher wine, because by kosher law, kosher wines are not permitted to use any animal products. So they're fined with bentonite, which is a finely ground clay based on volcanic ash, and there's no animal product involved. So that leaves the question, how can you tell if a wine is kosher? Well, you look at the back label of the bottle for a big O or a circle with the letter K in it for kosher, or possibly the letter P, which means kosher for Passover. Or you can go to kosherwine.com for a long list of kosher wines. And this is not a problem, really. Excellent kosher wines in many varieties from Bordeaux to Moscato are made all around the world. So if this makes you go home and want to give away all the wines in your cellar, I would be happy to help you. And I'll bet Bonnie would help me too.
Of course.
Yeah, of course. So, but actually, Fred, then there's no ingredients list on a wine label, correct?
Uh-uh.
No, you'll never see this on a wine label, but you just have to go to their website. But it's a good idea. You can find out where to buy wines, where you find a particular wine, too. You just Google the wine and find the website and look up the Consumer Relations Department.
Okay. Bonnie, did you have an email there?
Yeah, this is for Stephanie, actually. I think it's a man, I don't see a name, has for the last 15 years, he's 30, he's weighed 20 pounds underweight, and he says everything he eats does not agree with his stomach, especially processed food. So he said he wants to know what a regular everyday diet is that is accessible and realistic.
Oh gosh, that's a great question. I mean, the first thing that I would say if this person is listening, is that if you're that underweight, I'm hoping that you've gone to a doctor and perhaps somebody who's practicing integrative functional medicine that can look at a much broader picture of your health and see if there's anything wrong that is making it so hard for you to put on weight. You know, and ask him, perhaps he has one or two, very consistent, solid food allergies or sensitivities that are causing him to not be able to consume food in a way that is health supportive. And in the book, I offer a guide, a menu, really, of what I think for the average person a healthy diet looks like. But again, it's so specific to each person. Please never skip breakfast. Have a healthy balance of protein and fat and carbohydrate at breakfast. And so, for example, for me, a lot of times what I do is I do a green drink that's actually food, blended food, so like an avocado and nuts and greens and apple and cucumber and lemon and a little rice milk, and I'll do that, and sometimes I'll have a hard-boiled egg with that. And that really sustains me, and it gives me very valuable nourishment.
You know, it's interesting what you're saying, Stephanie, here, because you make this kind of drink or whatever it is that you have, but what you're telling us is that is a well-balanced meal, because it seems to me you've got the protein and you've got the fats content, vegetable fat content with the avocado and all. So even though I think the most important thing is what you mentioned earlier in the program, that the meal should be well-balanced and within a portion control. Would you agree with that?
Yes, absolutely. And any of these fads, I advise highly staying away from them, because statistically they fail. And so your best bet is to educate yourself about food, start investing a little time. On average, a person invests 15 hours of time to buy one car.
Oh.
And granted, it's a very expensive purchase.
Stephanie, you know what? We could talk to you for another several hours, but we're just out of time. It's been really interesting. Thank you so much for joining us.
Yes, and thank you for having me.
Well, her book, you get more information from her book, is What the Fork Are You Eating? It's a fascinating look at the food industry and an important read. Fred Tasker, great advice as always.
Always a pleasure.
Stay warm, Fred.
Yeah,
I'll try.
Joseph Cooper, Bonnie Berman.
He has wine to keep him warm. Thank you, Linda.
Great to be with you. Well, next week, going to be talking with Chef Todd Erickson about tacos and Miami Herald food editor Evan Benn about beer, because they're going to talk us about Super Bowl feasts.
Oh.
Well, I'm Linda Gassenheimer. Join me then.
And that wraps up today's program. We hope you enjoyed it. Producer Richard Ives, technical direction from online producer Paul Leary. Want a friend to hear it? There are free audio downloads at WLRN.org. Also links and such at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Remember, tomorrow it's Ed Bell and the South Florida Arts Beat. I think there's going to be some Cuban bebop live, Bonnie.
It's Latin jazz bebopper Orlando Sanchez and his band.
All right. We return Monday and discuss the European Union's tribulations with FIU political science professor Marcus Thiel. And today we have a calendar, Bonnie.
Okay, good.
On this day in 1904, 111 years ago, the birth of legendary choreographer and composer George Balanchine in St. Petersburg, Russia. He co-founded the New York City Ballet and led it for 35 years. And on this day in 1973, 42 years ago, George Foreman gains a TKO over Joe Frazier to gain the heavyweight title in Kingston, Jamaica. Should I do Cosell, Bonnie?
No.
Down goes Frazier! Down goes Frazier!
I guess it didn't matter what I said.
One more while we recall the Kojak years. On this day in 1994, 21 years ago, the death of actor Telly Savalas at age 70. He was in The Birdman of Alcatraz, The Dirty Dozen, about Kelly's Heroes. Credited with making a bald pate sexy, we leave with a thought from Telly Savalas, quote, "Kojak is the kind of guy who couldn't arrest a hooker. He'd send her home. He operates on instinct and decency, but if you give him any lip, he'll throw you out a window." Coochie coo, who loves you, baby?